And good afternoon. You're listening to Kim Hudnall. This is the Kim Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is June the 3rd, 154th day of the year. 211 days remain till the year is over with. In 350 AD, the Roman usurper, Napoleonus, of the Constantinian dynasty, proclaims himself Roman emperor, entering Rome at the head of a group of gladiators. 713, the Byzantine emperor Philippicus is blinded, deposed, sent into exile by conspirators of the Upsician army in Thrace. He's succeeded by Anastasios II, who begins a reorganization of the Byzantine army. In 1140, the French scholar Peter Abelard is found guilty of heresy. Believe the way I do, or you will die. 1326, the Treaty of Novgorod delineates borders between Russia and Norway and Finnmark. 1539, Hernando de Soto claims Florida for Spain. Never did find the Fountain of Youth, though. I guess he didn't check the right grocery store. Or soda shop. 1608, Samuel de Champlain lands at Tadoussac, Quebec, in the course of his third voyage to New France, begins erecting fortifications. He came to stay. 1621, a Dutch West India Company receives a charter for New Netherland. 1658, Pope Alexander VII appoints François de Laval, Vicar Apostolic in New France. 1665, James Stuart, Duke of York, who later became King James II of England, defeats the Dutch fleet off the coast of Lowestoft. 1781, Jack Jouett begins his midnight ride to warn Thomas Jefferson and Virginia legislature of an impending raid by Banastre Tarleton. 1839, in Humen, China, Lin Si Hu destroys 1.2 million kilograms of opium confiscated from British merchants, providing Britain with a casus belli to open hostilities. This led to the First Opium War. 1861, American Civil War, Battle of Philippi, also called the Philippi Races. Union forces rout Confederate troops in Barbour County, Virginia, which is now part of West Virginia. 1864, American Civil War, Battle of Cold Harbor. Union forces attack Confederate troops in Hanover County, Virginia. 1866, the Fenians are driven out of Fort Erie, Ontario, back into the United States. 1885, in the last military engagement fought on Canadian soil, the Cree leader Big Bear escapes the Northwest Mounted Police. They don't always get their man. 1889, the first long-distance electric power transmission line in the U.S. is completed. It runs 14 miles between a generator in Willamette Falls in downtown Portland, Oregon. 1916, the National Defense Act is signed into law, increasing the size of the United States National Guard by 450,000 men. 1935, 1,000 unemployed Canadian workers board freight cars in Vancouver, beginning a protest track to Ottawa. 1937, the Duke of Windsor marries Wallis Simpson. He abdicated to marry her. 1940, World War II, the Luftwaffe bombs Paris. 1940, World War II, the Battle of Dunkirk ends with a German victory and the Allied forces in full retreat. Also in 1940, Franz Rademacher proposes plans to make Madagascar the Jewish homeland, an idea that had been first considered by 19th century journalist Theodore Herzl. 1941, World War II, the Wehrmacht razes the Greek village of Kandanos to the ground and murders 180 of its inhabitants. 1942, World War II, Japan begins the Aleutian Islands campaign by bombing Unalaska Island. 1943 in Los Angeles, California, while White U.S. Navy sailors and Marines attack Latino youth in the five-day Zoot Suit Riots. 1950, Herzog and Lacanal of the French Annapurna Expedition become the first climbers to reach the summit of an 8,000-meter peak. 1962, at Paris Orly Airport, Air France Flight 007 overruns a runway and explodes when the crew attempts to abort takeoff. 130 people die in that disaster. 1963, soldiers of the South Vietnamese Army attack protesting Buddhists in Hue with liquid chemicals and tear gas grenades. 67 people had to be hospitalized for blistering of the skin and respiratory ailments. 1965, the launch of Gemini 4, the first multi-day space mission by a NASA crew. Ed White, a crew member, performs the first American spacewalk. 1969, Melbourne-Evans collision off the coast of South Vietnam. The Australian aircraft carrier HMAS Melbourne cuts the U.S. Navy destroyer USS Frank Evans in half. 1973, a Soviet supersonic Tupolev Tu-144 crashes near Goussainville in France. Kills 14. That's the first crash of a supersonic passenger aircraft. 1979, a blowout of the Ixtoc 1 oil well in the southern Gulf of Mexico causes at least 3 million barrels of oil to be spilled into the water. That's the second worst accidental oil spill ever recorded. 1980, an explosive device is detonated at the Statue of Liberty. FBI suspects Croatian nationalist. 1980, in my experience with the FBI, they couldn't find the rear end with both hands, a flashlight, and a map. So, Croatian nationalist? I tend to doubt it. 1980 Grand Island tornado outbreak hits Nebraska. Causes 5 deaths and $300 million in damages. That $300 million in 2020 dollars would be about $942 million. 1982, the Israeli ambassador to the UK, Shlomo Argov, is shot on a London street. He survives the shooting, but he's left paralyzed. 1984, Operation Blue Star, a military offensive, is launched by the Indian government of Harmandir Sahib, also known as the Golden Temple, the holiest shrine for Sikhs in Amritsar. Operation continues till June 6th with casualties, most of them civilians, in excess of 5,000. 1989, the government of China sends troops to force protesters out of Tiananmen Square after 7 weeks of occupation. 1991, Mount Unzin erupts in Kyushu, Japan, kills 43, all of them either researchers or journalists. 1992, Aboriginal land rights are granted in Australia in Mabo versus Queensland, number 2, a case brought by Eddie Mabo. 1998, after suffering a mechanical failure, a high-speed train derails in Ashita, Germany, kills 101. 2006, Union of Serbia and Montenegro comes to an end with Montenegro's former Declaration of Independence. 2012, a plane carrying 153 people crashes in a residential neighborhood in Lagos, Nigeria, kills everybody on board the plane and 10 people on the ground. 2012, a pageant for the Diamond Jubilee of Elizabeth II takes place on the River Thames. 2013, a trial of U.S. Army Private Chelsea Manning for leaking classified information to WikiLeaks begins in Fort Meade, Maryland. 2013, at least 119 people are killed in a fire at a poultry farm in Jilin Province in northeastern China. That's a foul occurrence. 2015, explosion of the gas lease station in Accra, Ghana, kills more than 200. 2017, London Bridge attack. 8 people are murdered and dozens of civilians are wounded by Islamist terrorists. 3 of the attackers are shot dead by the police. And in 2019, we have the Khartoum massacre. In Sudan, over 100 people were killed when security forces accompanied by Janjaweed militiamen storm and open fire on a city in protest. A lot of births and deaths on this day in history. Holidays, observances. Christian Feast Day. Charles Lwanga and Companions in the Roman Catholic Church. In Uganda, we have Martyrs Day. Clotilde. Kevin O'Glendalough. Ovidius. Vladimirskaya in the Russian Orthodox Church. In Kentucky, Louisiana, and Tennessee, we have Confederate Memorial Day. Buenos Aires, Argentina, we have Economist Day. In Australia, we have Mabo Day. In Taiwan, the Opium Suppression Movement Day. And it's World Bicycle Day. All right, let's see what else we got. In 1621, the Dutch West India Company gets a charter for the West Indies. That's the Americas, Caribbean, and West Africa. 1929, Chile and Peru signed the Treaty of Lima, finally resolving their border dispute from the War of the Pacific. Chile keeps Arica and Peru regains Tacna. 1989, that's the beginning of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Let's see what else we have. In 1098, Christian crusaders of the First Crusade seized Antioch, Turkey. 1784, the U.S. Congress formally created the United States Army to replace the disbanded Continental Army. June 14, 1775, the Second Continental Congress created the Continental Army for purposes of common defense. And this was considered to be actually the birth of the United States Army. In 1800, John Adams moved to Washington, D.C. He was the first president to live in what later became the capital of the United States. 1805, a peace treaty between the U.S. and Tripoli is completed in the captain's cabin on board the USS Constitution. 1851, the New York Knickerbockers became the first baseball team to wear uniforms. 1856, Colin Whipple patented the screw machine. 1888, Casey at the Bat, the poem by Ernest Lawrence Thayer's first published. 1923, in Italy, Benito Mussolini granted women the right to vote. In 1938, the German Reich voted to confiscate so-called degenerate art. 1952, rebellion by North Korean prisoners in the Kogi prison camp in South Korea is put down by American troops. 1959, the first class graduated from the Air Force Academy in Denver. 1970, Har Gobind Khorana and colleagues announced the first synthesis of a gene from chemical components. 1999, Slobodan Milosevic's government accepted an international peace plan concerning Kosovo. NATO announced that airstrikes will continue until 40,000 Serb forces are withdrawn from Kosovo. 1999, Dennis Muren receives a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. 2003, Sammy Sosa of the Chicago Cubs broke a bat when he grounded out against the Tampa Bay Devil Rays. It was a cork bat that he was using. 2003, Toys R Us announced that it had signed a multi-year agreement with Albertsons to become the exclusive toy provider for all Albertsons food and drug stores. And in 2017, the Amazing World of Dr. Seuss Museum opened in Springfield, Massachusetts. Okay. On June 3rd, 1989, Iran's spiritual leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini died. In 1781, Captain Jack Jouet began riding his horse 40 miles from Louisa County, Virginia, to Charlottesville, where Governor Thomas Jefferson and other politicians were located. He went to warn them of approaching British troops who intended to take him prisoner. 1861, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas, the Democratic presidential nominee in the 1860 election, died in Chicago of typhoid. He's 48. 1939, the French liner Normandy set a record for its maiden voyage, arriving in New York after crossing the Atlantic in just 4 days. 1948, the 200-inch reflecting Hale telescope at the Palomar Mountain Observatory in California was dedicated. 1968, Andy Warhol was shot and critically wounded at his New York film studio, known as The Factory, by Valerie Solanas, an actress and Estelle Saub, militant feminist. She served 3 years in prison for assault. 1977, the U.S. and Canada agreed to set up diplomatic interest sections in each other's countries. On this date, Cuba also announced the immediate release of 10 Americans jailed on drug charges. 2008, Barack Obama claimed the Democratic presidential nomination. He didn't claim it as much as it was given to him. He spoke in the same St. Paul, Minnesota arena where Republicans will be holding their national convention in September of that year. 2016, heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali died at a hospital in Scottsdale, Arizona. He was 74. In 20, let's see. In 2010, no, I'm sorry, 2011, New Hampshire became the sixth state to legalize same-sex marriage. The Organization of American States cleared the way for Cuba's possible return to the group by lifting a 47-year ban on that country. Coco Taylor, 80 years old, the queen of the blues in Chicago and Las Vegas, died. 2016, Obama arrived in Warsaw, Poland at the start of a three-country swing. Pledged to boost U.S. military deployments and exercises throughout Europe. Tens of thousands of Syrians in government-controlled cities voted to give President Bashar Assad a new 7-year mandate. The election was announced, denounced as a farce. And in 2020... President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, stressed that Trump's legal team would fight any effort to force Trump to testify in front of a grand jury during the special counsel's Russia probe. Graduating seniors at the Florida High School where a gunman killed 17 people in February received diplomas and heard from surprise commencement speaker Jimmy Fallon. Talk about somebody being given a gift. Fallon got the biggest gift of all when he got the Tonight Show. Let's see. Guatemala's volcano of fire, one of the most active volcanoes in Central America, erupted. Killed more than 100 and left scores missing. Okay, what else have we got? There we go. Okay. It's Chimborazo Day. It's Corpus Christi Day. Impersonate Authority Day, Jefferson Davis' birthday. Love Conquers All Day, National Chocolate Macaroon Day, National Egg Day. National Itch Day, World Clubfoot Day, it's Black Single Parents Week, National African Violet Week, National CPR and AED Awareness Week, Prepare Tomorrow's Parents Month, Scripps National Spelling Bee, and Step Parents Week. Okay. Famous birthdays, 1808, Jefferson Davis, President of the Confederacy, 1840, Michael O'Loughlin, American conspirator in the assassination of President Lincoln. 1844, Garrett Hobart, American lawyer, politician, and 24th Vice President of the U.S. 1864, Ransom Olds, American businessman who found Oldsmobile. 1925, Tony Curtis was born. 1950, Denise Williams, American singer, songwriter, and producer. 1954, Dan Hill, Canadian singer and songwriter. In 1899, Johann Strauss, Austrian composer, died. 1975, Ozzie Nelson, producer, director, and bandleader, died. In 2010, Lou McClanahan, played on Maude and Golden Girls. She died. 2011, James Arness of Gunsmoke fame died. 1929, actor and naval officer for World War II, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., marries actress Joan Crawford, New York City. 1989, Reba McEntire married her manager, Norvell Blackstone, in Emerald Bay and Lake Tahoe. I think we've come to the end. You know, we've talked a lot about the assassination of President John Kennedy. But there was another Kennedy who was assassinated. And there's a lot of information that's come to light about the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy. All right. Well, there's a lot of evidence regarding the assassination of Robert Kennedy that was, well, for lack of a better term, hidden by the powers that be. Stanislaus Brzezinski, who owns a cafe these days, is a reporter who traveled from Warsaw. He had a recorder running and recorded the speech that Kennedy gave. Senator Kennedy gave it the Ambassador Hotel that night. He continued to keep the recorder running as he walked around the ballroom and followed the entourage to the press conference that was going to take place after the victory speech. After he left California, he traveled up to Canada. And after a few days in Canada, the Canadian police requested a copy of that tape. And they sent it to the FBI, who found nothing at the time. So that recording went to the California State Archives, where it sat from through 2004. Now, in a review by the FBI and the LAPD, it was deemed insignificant to investigators because it sounded like 8 shots were fired. And it survived the massive destruction of evidence that took place at the hands of the police and made its way to the California Archives, where it sat for 30-some-odd years. Now, the police in L.A. destroyed all the evidence they could relating to the assassination of Robert Kennedy. There was never any explanation given for that. Now, the Brzezinski's recordings of that shooting came to light a few years ago, analyzed by Phil Van Praagh, an audio expert, using modern computer software. And that software can differentiate between sounds that are missed by the human ear and the human brain because they're too close together. In fact, modern software can detect sounds that are even milliseconds separated from one another. For example, there are 2 independent shots heard on the tape, they're only 120 milliseconds apart. According to the report issued by Van Prague, the software picked up 13 different distinct sounds of guns being fired. Now, to the human ear, five of these shots appear to be sound almost simultaneously. So police didn't know about it when the recording was initially listened to in 1968. So when you look at the chart of the recordings that was made, you can see there were 13 different spikes on the timeline produced by the software. And the fact that these weren't heard at the time helped hide and protect that tape for some 40 years. Otherwise, LAPD would have thrown it into the incinerator with all the other evidence they had collected. Now, the presence of more than 8 shots on that tape was corroborated by forensic audio experts Wes Dooley and Paul Pegas of Audio Engineering Associates in Pasadena, and forensic audio and ballistic expert Eddie Brixen of Copenhagen, Denmark, and audio specialist Phil Spencer Whitehead of the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, granted, I wouldn't put much stock in anything that came out of Georgia, but people do. William Turner, a former chemist who worked for the FBI for 10 years, stated this investigation wasn't botched. It was deliberately covered up. And since I was in L.A. when they were tearing down the hotel where he was shot, and I asked one of the supervisors why they were tearing down a perfectly good hotel, he said, "We were told to." Now, according to the book written by William Turner, there were 2 bullets found in the divider where the swinging doors to the pantry were attached to. There were 2 other bullets found in the wall panel. 1 more bullet was found in the area going out to the stage area. And 5 of the guests were hit with bullets. And 3 bullets hit RFK and 1 went through his jacket. So if you count all the bullets and compare it to the tape, you've got 13 bullets. In fact, there's an Associated Press photo published June 5th, 1968 that showed 2 LAPD officers pointing out 2 bullets lodged in a door jamb between the double doors where Kennedy went into the pantry. Now, Bobby Kennedy had planned to leave the stage and walk through the ballroom to greet his supporters and make his way to a secondary gathering of supporters elsewhere in the hotel. But with deadlines for printing their newspapers fast approaching, reporters pushed for a press conference to be held immediately after the victory speech was given. Campaign aide Fred Dutton decided that Senator Kennedy would abandon the plan to meet with the second group of supporters and instead go through the kitchen and pantry area behind the ballroom to get to the colonial room where they were going to have the press conference. So Senator Kennedy finished speaking and started to exit when William Barry, the head of the RFK security, stopped him and said, "No, it's been changed. We're going this way." So Barry and Dutton cleared the way for Kennedy to go left through swinging doors into the kitchen corridor. But Kennedy was hemmed in by the crowd, so he followed hotel maitre d' Carl Ulicker through another door that would lead into the kitchen pantry corridor. Now, escorted by his entourage of staff, volunteers, and an armed security guard hired by the hotel, Kennedy followed instructions. And the entourage exited the ballroom and entered the corridor of the kitchen. Now, that armed security guard was named Eugene Thane Cesar, worked for Ace Security Company. Senator Kennedy shook hands and walked along the corridor with security guard Cesar walking behind him. I've never seen a security guard walking behind the person he's supposed to protect. Usually they lead the way. Well, as they got into the kitchen, standing among the staff is an unemployed 24-year-old Palestinian man named Sirhan Bissara Sirhan. He pulls out a pistol and allegedly shot Kennedy, and other people are also in the kitchen corridor. Now, this last-minute decision to go through the kitchen corridor to get to the colonial room was a major mistake, no question about it. So you have to ask, was Bill Barry or Fred Dutton in on the plan for the waiting assassin? Or was there possibly an outside person who they trusted who urged them to take that different path?
Kitchen staff indicated that Sirhan and another girl had been in the kitchen for quite some time. And they knew that Senator Kennedy would be coming down the hallway. So Sirhan was standing there waiting to pounce, which means he knew in advance where Kennedy was going to go. Now, one of the major indicators that we're dealing with a conspiracy is the glaring evidence of simple mathematics. Count the number of bullets that have fired into the room that night and compare it with the number of bullets can be held in the revolver that Sirhan was brandishing on that fateful night. He was carrying a .22 caliber Ivor Johnson cadet revolver, which held only 8 bullets. The medical examiner recorded that Senator Kennedy was actually shot with 3 bullets. A 4th bullet missed his body and went through his suit coat. 5 more bullets were fired and hit 5 people who were also in that kitchen corridor. Now, the 5 people who were shot, in addition to Kennedy, were Paul Schrade, an official with the United Auto Workers Union, William Weissel, an ABC-TV unit manager, Ira Goldstein, a reporter for the Continental News Service, Elizabeth Evans, a friend of Pierre Salinger, one of Kennedy's campaign aides, and a teenager by the name of Erwin Stroll, a Kennedy volunteer. Now, in addition to these 9 bullets, 4 more were fired into various parts of the kitchen, such as the doorway and the ceiling. So, when you finish counting, you've accounted for 13 bullets that were supposedly fired from a gun that only carried 8. And not only were these bullets photographed by police and FBI investigators, but the police dismantled the doorway partition and the ceiling tile components and took them into custody as evidence, where they were later destroyed. Now, there was a lot of discussion about whether or not Sirhan was there of his own volition, or he was what was referred to later as a Manchurian candidate. He was supposedly the victim of the MK-Ultra mind control program. But we'll talk about that later. Now, after winning the Democratic primaries in Indiana, Nebraska, and South Dakota, Senator Kennedy won the all-important California primary June 4th. And his position to challenge Republican candidate former Vice President Richard Nixon for the White House. Now, this was a very turbulent period in our history, with the campaigns being run amidst the stormy backdrop of the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4th, and all the race riots that broke out across more than 100 cities across the country, and all the anti-war confrontations taking place between police and protesters on college campuses and in cities around the country. LBJ was president after taking office following the assassination of John Kennedy and being reelected in 1964. On March 31st, he announced he was not going to seek re-election. That cleared the way for his endorsement of his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, to run for president. Well, after midnight, and the word being spread that Kennedy had won the California primary, Kennedy gave his victory speech to hundreds of supporters, volunteers, and friends. Well, now, to satisfy all the critics who would naturally respond that somehow Sirhan was able to quickly fire off those 8 rounds that were in the Ivor Johnson gun that he had, a firearms expert by the name of Phil Spangenberger was given the same gun that Sirhan had originally used. First, he tested to see how fast he could fire that weapon, meaning he fired all 8 bullets one after the other. His fastest time in between firing all 8 rounds was 2.93 seconds. In testing how fast he could fire with only 2 shots, the fastest he could do was 0.55 seconds. Fire cry from the 120 milliseconds that was recorded. He also added that the .22 caliber Ivor Johnson cadet revolver is a very low-end gun. It's not accurate past a few feet. Now, there was another wrinkle to the investigation. Eugene Thane Cesar, the security guard, couldn't seem to keep his story straight. Now, the hotel had hired private security guards to work the various events that day. One such man was armed and assigned to escort Senator Kennedy from the ballroom to the Colonial Room, Eugene Thane Cesar. And the company he worked for gave him a gun. It was a .38. Now, even though he was an armed man present at the shooting of Senator Kennedy, the LAPD did not examine the gun that he carried. It's possible that Cesar switched the .38 that he'd been issued for a .22 Ivor Johnson to match what Sirhan would be using that evening. In other words, there's a lot of suspicion that Cesar was actually involved in the assassination. Investigators later discovered that Cesar actually owned a .22, and he was asked to produce it for examination. He refused, saying he'd already sold it. Well, the investigation into that claim continued. It was later discovered he lied about when it was sold, and records show he actually sold it several weeks after that point in time, on September 6, 1968. He told the LAPD he'd worked for this Ace Security Company for 6 months before the shooting. Later on, it was discovered he actually only worked three jobs for him before the one at the Ambassador Hotel, and he was never before in that particular hotel, as he told the investigation. Now, witnesses reported that he did not lead from the front, but walked behind Senator Kennedy. Now, for somebody, as I said, assigned to escort somebody, it's very odd that he followed the senator. If you're instructed to escort somebody through a heavily crowded area, you want to do it from the front, not from behind. Particularly so for an armed and uniformed security guard who obviously have a greater degree of ease in breaking through the crowd to get his protected VIP through crowded areas quickly. And the hotel maitre d', Carl Euchre, knew they'd be going through the kitchen. The double doors were blocked with people, so the maitre d' took them through a back door that also led to the kitchen pantry area. Now, a few witnesses stated they saw Cesar firing his own weapon. However, during the initial reports, the LAPD stated that nobody had a drawn gun, not even a security guard. Additionally, police investigators did not seize Cesar's weapon to run forensics on it and see if it had been fired that day. Now, if you're doing a thorough investigation, this is absolutely unforgivable, and it makes it appear that a cover-up was, in fact, underway. Don Shulman, a runner for KNXT-TV in L.A., had been standing behind Kennedy as he walked through the pantry and seen the security guard fire three times. Immediately after the shooting, Shulman reported his story on the radio and insisted Kennedy was shot three times. And even though the early media reports and crime scene witnesses generally stated their firm belief the senator was only hit twice, Shulman stuck to his story. Kennedy had been hit three times, and the autopsy proved he was right. Now, in 1987, a reporter tracked down and located Eugene Thane Cesar. During an interview, he admitted he had his gun drawn, but he said he didn't fire. Clearly, this was a discrepancy with what the police reported. So, did he lie to the police initially, stating his gun was never drawn, or did he state to police that he drew his gun when the police cited different facts later on? How was this resolved? Well, we don't know. Now, if Eugene Thane Cesar did shoot Senator Kennedy, it would line up perfectly with what the county coroner reported, because he stated that the gunshot wound to the head was fired less than 1 inch away from Senator Kennedy's head. Dr. Noguchi, the medical examiner, reported that the abundance of powder burn embedded deep in the tissue and in Senator Kennedy's hair indicated the gun was less than 1 inch away from his head, if not directly pressed against Kennedy's head when it was fired. It's also interesting that a gunshot wound behind the ear into the head is generally considered a mob-style execution. Dr. Noguchi also testified the other two bullet wounds that hit the senator also came from behind him as well. Now, some folks have said they believe that Sirhan's .22 had blanks in it, He was to create a distraction. And once the audience freaked out, then the security guard, Eugene Cesar, was to fire his weapon into the head of Senator Kennedy. And frankly, he was in the perfect position to inflict that wound, as it was described in Dr. Noguchi's report. When somebody innocently asked Cesar, would he have even voted for Senator Kennedy for president? He said, I definitely wouldn't have voted for Bobby Kennedy because he had the same ideas as John. And I think John sold the country down the road. He gave it to the commies. Gave it to whomever wanted it, but he literally gave it to the minorities. Well, that sounds like a lot of pent-up anger. So would you want a man that felt that way walking behind him with a loaded gun? Well, it might interest everybody to know that Eugene Thane Cesar left the U.S. a number of years ago and now resides in the Philippines. Now, the hotel maitre d', Carl Euchre, was asked how did Sirhan manage to shoot the senator in the back of the head. Well, Euchre said that wasn't possible, as Sirhan was several feet in front of him. In other words, Carl Euchre stood between the senator and Sirhan as they walked forward down that corridor. Maybe this is when we get our inspector to step up so he can spout off more of his nonsense about his world-famous magic bullet theory. When he was a district attorney working for the Warren Commission, he explained to the world how the bullet that went through President Kennedy turned around in midair and hit Governor Conley. And in its conclusion, the Warren Commission emphatically stated it found persuasive evidence from the experts that a single bullet caused the president's neck wound and the wounds to Governor Conley. Well, during the 8-month police and FBI investigation following the murder of Senator Kennedy, there were more than 2,400 photographs that were taken and compiled as evidence. The trial of Sirhan began February 12, 1969, and lasted 2 months. And he was convicted of shooting the senator on April 17, 1969, sentenced to death 6 days later during a sentencing hearing. Now, this being California, the land of fruits and nuts, his death sentence was commuted to life in prison. Now, many people didn't agree with the lone crazed gunman and cited numerous investigative errors that had taken place. And when other entities began to launch independent investigations, they were told that the LAPD had burned and incinerated all the evidence, including the 2,400 photographs, as well as the portions of the hotel kitchen that were dismantled because they contained bullets. When confronted with the demand for an explanation to why the police would do such a crazy thing, LAPD Chief Daryl Gates said they were running out of room in the evidence room. Specifically states of the Senator Kennedy murdered evidence, you can't keep junk around forever, and they took up a lot of room. Well, incinerating evidence to one of the most shocking political assassinations of the century would certainly put a bump in the road for those who might want to dig into the circumstances a bit deeper than the LAPD and the FBI had done. One might possibly concede that a small-town police department would do such a crazy thing. Maybe such as the one you might find in the rural mountains of eastern Pennsylvania, but coming from the chief of police of the second largest city in the U.S., now that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Now this action by any sizable law enforcement entity is absolutely absurd, unthinkable, unforgivable, especially when you think about the magnitude of the crime. Just on these few points alone, we began to see the initial trappings of quite an elaborate and extensive cover-up. Who or what would have so much pull and muscle that one of the most heralded police departments in the country be willing to literally put their own necks in a noose, publicly jeopardizing their careers and their reputations in order to cover up for another entity or organization? We're now bluntly stating we clearly have the makings of a conspiracy between the LAPD and the FBI collaborating together to engineer an extensive cover-up for one of the most shocking political assassinations our country has seen. And over the week that followed after the assassinations, all three major TV networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC, each broadcast more than 40 hours of coverage on the Senator Kennedy assassination. And these stories were carried all around the world. So when you consider the overwhelming pressure of the entire world watching these ongoing newscasts week after week, in 1968, when live television coverage was an exciting new technology that recently observed, The pressure that law enforcement grapples with doing any kind of highly public investigation or trial would include extensive bravado, face-saving, not wanting to make embarrassing mistakes, wanting to appear to be in control. Well, with worldwide public interest, now consider the huge counterweight that must be necessary for the LAPD and the FBI to be willing to proceed forward with their own cover-up effort. Now, we can be hypothetical and speculate with some possible ideas. Maybe the chief of police is being blackmailed or had ties to organized crime. That might make it a bit more feasible, but let's remember the FBI was also there for the entire 8 months of the investigation, working side by side with the LAPD. And given the national structure of the FBI, we'd hope that an internationally observed investigation of a presidential candidate would elicit the common sense strategy of sending in federal investigators that would be immune from local or even regional bullying tactics of underworld figures. More specifically, if an LAPD chief were in bed or on the payroll of a Southern California mobster, then the national directors of the FBI would have the foresight to send in an investigative team from other parts of the country. Even if they did, we see ample evidence that even the FBI investigators and their superiors fell sway to whatever forces were by organizing this cover-up. So who on the planet could exert such influence over LAPD and the FBI that be willing to risk everything in such a way? Think of what could happen to the careers of all these men if the cover story were blown up by some journalist and their careers would be forever damaged. They were risking their jobs, their reputations, their families for some larger entity that was engineering this cover-up. Now, many folks might cite organized crime and mobsters as somebody who would have that kind of exceptionally extreme logic. Leverage. Now, some folks might even point out that when Robert Kennedy served as the U.S. Attorney General under his brother's administration from 61 to 64, he was relentless in going after organized crime and the Teamsters. They'd argue this seems motive enough for retaliation in having Kennedy murdered. And that's partially true. As the Attorney General, Kennedy held public hearings that were televised across the country against the Teamsters, and all of Kennedy's attention was focused directly on the Teamsters Union president, Jimmy, where are you now, Hoffa? During these lengthy public hearings held in 1962, there was never any conviction, and the final outcome was a hung jury. Jimmy Hoffa went free. It wasn't until a number of years later, 1967, he was convicted and sent to prison for a 13-year sentence after the damaging testimonies of one of his mob partners, Edward Parton. In another case, it was prosecuted by James Neal in Tennessee. So if Jimmy Hoffa was involved in the assassination, why would he wait 6 years to retaliate and come after Senator Kennedy? That just didn't make any sense. Jimmy Hoffa would more than likely have gone after Edward Parton or the prosecutor that actually sent him to prison, James Neal. Additionally, at the time of the assassination, Hoffa himself was in prison. And the CIA is most definitely an entity that might have such considerable pull and muscle as to intimidate the LAPD as well as the FBI, but why would the CIA do that? Well, this is traced back to the early assassination of Robert Kennedy's brother, President John Kennedy, in Dallas, November 22, 1963. In both the John Kennedy assassination and the Bobby Kennedy assassination, we've got two extremely high-profile case political assassinations in front of a large numbers of people with the same story of a lone nut gunman. And both of these assassinations had had more bungling atrocities that might be somewhat comical if it were seen on a late-night B-rated movie instead of in real-life tragedies. Now, Lee Harvey Oswald immediately told reporters his being framed. He was set up by others. He was a patsy. He said that photograph of him holding that rifle wasn't him at all, but his head had been cut and pasted onto somebody else's body. And if you examine that world-famous photograph, you'll see two things immediately. The head is indeed out of proportion to the body, and the shadow on his nose from the sign is at a different angle than the shadow from his body on the ground. Incidentally, not only was that photograph produced extremely quickly that day, but a newspaper editor overseas later reported he received the photograph and press release a few hours before the assassination of Kennedy actually even occurred. And the rifle that Oswald allegedly shot Kennedy with on that day was an old used World War II rifle that was bought through a mail order advertisement for $19.95. Had a rusty firing pin, telescope had a magnification power of 4, and it was broken and wouldn't zero in at the target, and the sights on the rifle itself weren't zeroed in. Now, the distance was 265 feet from the sixth floor of the depository building to the target zone where Kennedy was first shot. And the presidential limousine was driving at 30 miles an hour. Now, Nelson Delgado, a Marine who knew Oswald and he was in the Marines, testified to the Warren Commission. Oswald was a lousy shot who was frequently flagged on the rifle shooting course for completely missing the target. Subsequently, Oswald was kicked out of the Marines with a discharge designation that stated undesirable. Oswald wrote a letter to Connally in 1962 asking that his undesirable discharge from Marine be reconsidered. Now, if you look at the shadow cast from Oswald's body onto the ground, the orientation, the length of the shadow suggests the sun's to Oswald's left and relatively low on the horizon. But the long, straight shadow into Oswald's nose suggests the sun is directly above him. These seemingly incongruous shadows have led to speculation Oswald's head was pasted onto the scene. In fact, Oswald himself claimed that the photo was a fake and had been altered to falsely implicate him. Now, the matte photograph that was found in a desk drawer of a Dallas police detective gives support to the fact that the final photo was faked. Such methods were used in those days prior to computers and Photoshop software to doctor photos. And CBS News hired and retained 11 rifle sharpshooters, and they set up similar test conditions that supposedly Oswald fired under. And none of the 11 expert sharpshooters able to duplicate Oswald's feat with 3 hits in 8 seconds at a distance of 795 feet. And that was at a stationary target, not moving at 20 to 30 miles per hour, as was the president's limousine. 2 world-class snipers said the shots credited to Oswald were literally impossible, and they themselves couldn't have made the shots. U.S. Marine Corps Vietnam sniper Craig Roberts wrote a book called Kill Zone, describing his analysis of the Kennedy assassination at Dealey Plaza. And he said, without a shadow of a doubt, that the shots credited to Oswald were impossible. He said, I couldn't have done it after he saw the view from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. He went on to say, I analyzed the scene as a sniper would. I looked at the engagement angles, entirely wrong. 3 problems arose that would influence my shots. First, the target was moving away at a drastic angle to the right of from the window, meaning I'd have to position my body to compete with the wall and a set of vertical water pipes. This would be extremely difficult for a right-handed shooter, which is what Oswald was. Second, I'd have to be ready to fire exactly when the target emerged past some tree branches that obscured the kill zone. And finally, I'd have to deal with 2 factors at the same time. The curve of the street and the high to low angle formula. The law of physics that Oswald wouldn't have known because he was not a marksman. Gunnery Sergeant Carlos Hathcock, one of the most decorated combat snipers in U.S. military history, earned 93 confirmed kills in Vietnam and went on to become the senior instructor for the U.S. Marine Corps Sniper Instruction School at Quantico. When he was talked to, he said, let me tell you what we did at Quantico. We reconstructed the whole thing, the angle, the range, the moving target, the time limit, the obstacles, everything. I don't know how many times we tried, but we couldn't duplicate what the Warren Commission said Oswald did. Now, if I can't do it, how in the world could a guy who was a non-qual on the rifle range and later, after a lot of work, only qualified as a marksman, be able to do it? In the Marine Corps, the title of marksman is the lowest qualifying score on the rifle range. In order to qualify as an expert shooter on the rifle range in the Marine Corps, you have to score a combined 305 or greater from tables 1 and 2. Marksman is the lowest score obtained with a scoring range of 250 to 279. Sharpshooter comes in second with a combined score falling between 280 and 304. FBI ballistics experts told the Warren Commission Oswald's rifle couldn't be fired, reloaded, aimed, and refired in less than 2.3 seconds. On the famous Zapruder film, this 2.3 seconds equals 42 frames. This gives us a ratio of 18.26 frames per 1 second of the Zapruder film. The Warren Commission stated President Kennedy was shot and wounded between 210 and 225 on his Zapruder film. When we see Kennedy after they go behind the sign, he's been shot already during that instant when the car goes behind the street sign. The problem is we now see Governor Connally being shot at frame 240. Now, given the fact we're not sure about where exactly the first shot is, only the range from frame 210 to 225, we're now in a position where we're saying that that is a time difference between 30 frames to 15 frames between the two shots. Using a ratio of 18.26 frames per second, we're saying the second shot only had between 0.82 seconds and 1.64 seconds to reload, aim, and fire that second round into Governor Connally, and that's not possible. So, he wants to guess what happened to the FBI ballistics expert who gave that sworn testimony. He was transferred to heaven knows where. That testimony demolished the case of the Warren Commission because it immediately states there had to be a second gunman. So this was the thought process behind the all-knowing, omniscient Arlen Specter to come up with the magic bullet theory. This theory states that belief that there would be wild new technology whereby a speeding bullet would penetrate through a person, come out the other side, stop in mid-flight, turn around 180 degrees and fly into another person sitting there in front of or to the side of the first victim. Now, this is utter and complete nonsense. And that was the quintessential codpen of which the government's claim of the Loma gunman rested. Because it was clearly proven it's absolutely impossible for even the fastest, most expert rifleman to have fired, reloaded, aimed, and refired in less than 2.3 seconds. Not even to mention that the target's a moving car proceeding forward at 10 to 30 miles an hour. Advocates of the lone shooter theory cite that Oswald was listed as a sharpshooter in the Marines. Well, this means absolutely nothing in the real world, as he also achieved the same score. It's basically a little confidence booster if you get a certain number of bullets into the target. Not a great deal of skills involved at all. It's just something to give you a Marine boot camp to boost your confidence and make you feel good about yourself. But at the end of the day, Arlen Specter's theory of the magic bullet was just simply something that the Warren Commission could use to close the case and do what Johnson told them to do, prove it wasn't a conspiracy. On that note, we come to the end of today's show. We're going to talk more about the Robert F. Kennedy assassination in our next show. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.